Over the decades, we've done oodles of programs on the evolution of the book. We've gone back to the time when the scroll evolved into the codex. We've talked of Christopher Columbus's son formalising the idea of a library. And we've discussed the history of libraries, personal and public. Now it's time to turn to the indexes. I must confess I often do before interviewing a guest to see whether I'm in his or her book. Then the other day, an intriguing little volume landed on the desk with the witty title, Index, A History of the... It plunges us into a history stretching back hundreds of years and reveals that the Humble Index is the most sophisticated search tool ever devised. The book's author is Dennis Duncan. If you're looking him up later, you'll find him under the letter D. Dennis is a writer, translator, lecturer in English at University College London, and he's a fellow of the Royal Historical Society. I'm delighted that he's on the blower now from London to share some of the curious stories he's discovered about indexes and their creators. Dennis, welcome to our little wireless program.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
Indexes have to be one of the most overlooked things in life, but you see them as more important than people think. Why?
Well, that's exactly right. I think when I tell people this is what I've done, writing a book about indexes and stuff, everybody says, well, isn't that incredibly niche? But if I say to them, well, have you used Google today? Everybody has. Our reliance on a certain type of index, the index that underpins the search engine, it's kind of total at the moment. We say we live in the age of search. So thinking about the history of the index is really thinking about the sort of hinterland of how did we come to be here. And it turns out that when we use Google, Google doesn't go off and search the web. It does that in the background, does that all the time anyway. Google calls that crawling. Google says its process is crawling and indexing. So it searches the web all the time and it puts those results into an index. And when you do a search, when you use a search engine, what you're searching is the index produced by this background crawling. So really, we're constantly relying on indexes. Every time we ask, you know, who did that person play for? Weren't they dead? What was she in? That kind of thing. Our sort of twitchy thirst for knowledge at the moment is because we have these sort of powerful indexes that we can use all of the time. And what's curious to me is that that technology that we use all of the time was invented about 800 years ago by monks in Western Europe.
Now, one of the fascinating things I learned from your book is that, in fact, the index was invented not once but twice. But take us through the sequence.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, so there's a handful of inventions that are invented simultaneously by two different people. I think the light bulb is one, mathematical calculus is another. And these are always really interesting because what they mean is that the time was so ripe that the sort of need, the cultural need for this thing was so ripe that two people have the same idea. So the year is about 1230. Let's say the year is 1230, early 13th century. And in Paris and in Oxford, two different people invent the book index. They look slightly different. The one that's invented in Paris by the friars at the Dominican friary of Saint-Jacques is what we call a concordance or a word index. It takes the Bible. The monks there took the Bible and broke it down into its constituent words. Every single word in the Bible, put them in alphabetical order, attach a little locator telling you where that word appears. Sin appears on every single page or whatever. So that's a word index, an alphabetical word index of the Bible. Across the channel in Oxford, there's a man called Robert Grosseteste, who was a total polymath, a wonderful man who read everything, read the Bible, read the church fathers, read pagan philosophy, read Aristotle, read the latest translations of Arabic philosophers. And in this complete sort of polymathic reading, he would make a note every time one of his sort of favorite topics. He's a list of about 400 topics. And every time one of these topics comes up, whether that's animals or the creation or the Trinity, he does a little symbol in the margins. And at the end, when he finishes reading a book, he will comb the margins and jot down a note of where each of these things appeared. And he put that into a general index. So he ends up with what he calls a grand table, grand tabula of every instance that the Trinity is mentioned across all of his reading. So it's, you know, it's like a kind of parchment Google. He's read everything and he can tell you where anything is. If you want to know where any of these concepts appear in the reading of the man who's read everything, he's got an index to tell you.
I want to go back and say a good word for the friars, because I learned from you that they listed about 10,000 individual words and 129,000 locations. Not a bad effort.
It's amazing, isn't it? I think the abbot, a man called Hugh of Sancerre, basically has all of the friars working at this. He says, this is going to be my big project. While I'm abbot, we're going to produce this thing, this new invention I've got called an index. And so the friars are essentially sort of corralled into doing this. And you can see their different handwritings. The notes that they used amazingly survived, actually. So not just the first index, but actually the notes towards the first index. And you can see you get allocated the letter T, you get allocated the letter U, you get allocated the letter W, and you can see the handwriting change, and you can see people who've skipped a word, so they've got to write it in with a little arrow smaller and so on. It's really fun.
Going back to Oxford, I'm very, very attracted by Robert, your polymath. And I love the story about him being called Big Head, not because he was arrogant, because there was so much stored between his ears.
That's right. So he's known as Robert Grosseteste, famous now. If you look into medieval history, if you Google him, Robert Grosseteste, there's even a university in the town of Lincoln in England named Robert Grosseteste University. So he's a major figure because he was Bishop of Lincoln. But Grosseteste might not be the family name. The suspicion is that actually it was just a nickname that stuck to him because he was so kind of capacious in his knowledge. He's right from the start. He comes from nothing. He comes from a very poor background. But this nickname of Robert the Big Head, Grosseteste, sort of sticks. He's the person whose head is just a warehouse for storage.
Dennis, why was there suddenly this need for an index? What was going
on? That's a really good question. So I say this, we're talking about the year 1230. What's happened are two things. One is the arrival of the universities. So I say Paris and Oxford are the centres of this. Not coincidentally, they are the places where the universities have just arrived. University as a concept has essentially sort of landed at the turn of the 13th century in Paris and Oxford. I'll come back to why that's important in a sec. The other thing that's just arrived are the preaching orders. So we think of monasteries, medieval monasteries, as being sort of out in the middle of nowhere, monks spending their lives in total seclusion. All you have to do is get up and drink and read, and that's your life. Now, because of various heresies in the 12th century, it's decided this won't entirely do. We need preachers who will live in the cities, who will stop the flock from going astray, people who are going to be, you know, not monks, but friars, the Dominicans and the Franciscans being the notable orders of friars who live among the people, live in the big cities, preach. So you have universities and you have preaching orders. You have two types of speaking. You have the lecture and the sermon. People need to write lectures, people need to write sermons. Suddenly they need to use books. Not just read books, but use books.
I love the point you make that if you're going to do a sermon on fish, you need to say, okay, where do we have fish? There's the feeding of the 5,000. What else is there?
That's exactly right. Yeah. Oh my God, I've got 3 days to write a sermon on fish. I'm going to preach about fish this weekend. So Okay, there's the feeding of 5,000. Exactly. What else is there? Now, if you have a handy list that tells you every moment that the word fish appears in the Bible, you can go, oh, that's great. I'm going to start with that. Or maybe I can't think of one. I can't think of one on fish. Let's say it's bread. I'm going to start with the feeding of the 5,000. Then, okay, I'm going to jump to the Lord's Prayer. Give us this day our daily bread. Maybe we'll have a little bit from the Old Testament. We'll jump back to manna from heaven. So there's that idea of provision. And suddenly your sermon is looking quite interesting already. You're jumping about. This is going to be a good one. So if we think of the lecture as kind of the same thing, in the new universities we have this new type of information delivery. We need to lecture to people. Again, how am I going to do that at short notice? I'm going to need to use my books in a more efficient way in order to navigate between the different moments, the different pieces of information that I want to deliver. So suddenly books stop being this slow linear thing that monks can read with all the time in the world, to kind of storehouses of morsels of information. And we want to put those morsels together in new combinations at short notice.
Talking to Dennis Duncan. And Dennis, indexes haven't always been neutral, of course. Tell us about how book indexes became or came to be weaponized as satirical devices.
Well, this is something that happens to any piece of technology that that sort of settles down. Once anybody knows how something works, early indexes, actually you find a paragraph explaining. Imagine this, a paragraph explaining how to use it. Well, first you need to know the order of the letters of the alphabet. But after a few hundred years, enough books have them. Readers basically know how they work. And what you then are able to do is play off that. You get these inventive authors who are able to use the index satirically. This happens at the start of the 18th century. And what we have is politicians who mock other politicians by publishing rogue indexes to their work. So say you're a politician, but as a youth you went on a tour of France and Italy and you wrote it up as a youthful travelogue. This really happened. Then As soon as you get a bit too big for your boots, your peers notice this. And when are we talking about? 1705, an edition was brought out of this one politician's travelogue, which is exactly the same as when he first published it, except now it's got an index. And the index isn't a useful one. In fact, the index just makes fun of all of the moments when this young politician was stupid or banal or spelt something wrong or used bad grammar, or when he was a bit too polite about the Pope. That this is 1705, so there's when he was a little bit too familiar with foreigners or a bit too generous about Catholicism. All of these things make it into the index there. The idea of the sort of weaponized index, actually, I can use an index to undermine the book rather than to support the book. No, to go the other way and undermine it becomes a thing. So we get some quite fun things. We still see this, actually. One of my favourite ones is with a British politician of about 20 years ago, and there's an entry that says, Aitken, Jonathan, admires risk takers, 59, goes to jail, 60.
Okay, your own book has two indexes. Please explain that to the ancient broadcaster.
Well, thank you very much for giving me the chance to do that. Yes, something that I worry about a bit now is that computers are coming for all of our jobs. And you'd think indexing is the kind of thing where computers are ripe to take over. But they're not there yet. And so I wanted to demonstrate that there is indexing software to produce. You give it your PDF and it'll produce an index for it. And I wanted to show how far that is from being any good. So in my book, I've got an index that's produced by state-of-the-art contemporary artificial intelligence indexing software and an index that's produced by a lady called Paula Clark Bain, who's a professional indexer from the Society of Indexes. And hers is so much better, so conspicuously better. It's funny, it's useful, it's clever, it can name things that I don't name in the book. She can spot subtext and stuff like that the computer can't do. So I really wanted to show, okay, you think computers can do everything. They're not there yet. Computers are handy for certain types of indexing. Like I say, Google's an index, or when we jump through a document with Control and F, that's all very well. But don't think that can index your book yet, because it's nowhere near what a good indexer can do.
I noticed in your index the name William F. Buckley jumped out at me because, believe it or not, he interviewed me some decades ago. Tell me about William F. Buckley writing a note to Norman Mailer in his book index.
That's amazing. That's really funny that you spoke to him. Right, well, this is the story that I heard the most when I was preparing this book. People would say, I hope you've included Buckley and Mailer. So this is a famous indexing anecdote that Buckley ran for mayor of New York in 1967. And he was unsuccessful, but he wrote a book about it called The Unmaking of a Mayor. And he has this kind of frenemy relationship with Norman Mailer. And when the book comes out, he sends a copy to Mailer, who has a small sort of supporting role in the narrative. And what he's done is at the back in the index under Mailer, comma, Norman, 319, he's scribbled in ballpoint pen, "Hi." Basically, the idea being that Norman Mailer is the ultimate narcissist who the first thing he's going to do is open the book, turn to the back and say, "Am I in it?"
That's what I confess to doing. It's a sin I share.
Buckley's got his number.
Oh, that's a funny thing. Look, I want to walk this back a bit before I let you go. There were attempts in the 19th century to create a sort of universal index summarising all of human knowledge. How was that meant to work, Dennis?
Well, that's a really good point. Now, this ultimately is what we do have. Like I started off by talking about Google as an index. The idea for, well, what if we have an index not just to one book, but if we scale that up, if we then have an index to a whole genre, so you do a sort of cumulative index of all of the history books, and then you scale that up to a cumulative index of all of the books of all types, what would that look like? This was developed in the 1870s by the Index Society in London. The idea being exactly this, that, okay, we'll make sure every book has an index. Then we'll get somebody to do a grand index of all the history books and all of the science books and all of the religious books and so on. Then we'll get somebody to do a grand index of all of that. It looks like a room in the Strand. They took a room in a building off the Strand in London, covered the walls in pigeonholes, and the idea was these pigeonholes would be full of slips, index cards, that were the sort of result of this abstraction process. This was the sort of brain of the world on index cards. It didn't work out, unfortunately. It fell down for lack of funding, but it was actually revisited in Belgium about 20 years later at the turn of the century, which you can still visit, an extraordinary room in Belgium that's full of index cards. Basically, like I say, the brain of the world. Before this could be digitized, the idea is every time you write something, you send an index card to the central repository of all of this information. Every time you want to know something, then you can send something to one of their librarians who will go flick through the index cards. It's hard not to use the idea of Google constantly. This is a sort of paper version of that.
Dennis, we're out of time and you're just warming up, but thanks for that. Dennis Duncan, writer, translator and a lecturer at University College London. His energy is all the more extraordinary because he told me off air that he's currently suffering with COVID. His book is Index, A History of the... and it's published by Penguin. Thanks very much, DD.